Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 8, The Perfection of Aditana, Dedication with Jack Kornfield.
In this evening's quality, the eighth of them, is in Pali or Sanskrit, the word is aditana, which means dedication or determination, it's sometimes translated. And the various qualities that we've spoken of, the generosity of heart, the quality of inner knowing or integrity, of truthfulness, of wisdom, and so forth. As you may recall, these are qualities that are spoken of in terms of hundreds of thousands of lifetimes in the mythology or the stories of the Buddhist tradition, through which one discovers the great capacities and strength of heart. In a simple way, that means that they're not found within time, but they are timeless qualities. There's the story of the usual seeker who climbed the great mountains and finally at the top of the mountains found the old wise man there. And he asked, "How do I attain holiness?" The wise man looked back simply and said, "You must follow your heart." And the man who climbed the mountains always said, "Well, that sounds pretty easy." The wise man said, "To follow your heart, you are also going to need a strong constitution." It's true, isn't it? I mean, there are things that we love or know or deeply value. But to actually stay with them and to live them completely or fully is a whole other question. Now, it's interesting, as we begin to notice, discover, awaken to the qualities within us of patience or energy or the generosity of heart that are there innately in us, these qualities become a kind of resource for us. I have a friend who was a Buddhist monk for many years in Asia, for 25 years. His name is Vimalo. Now he's disrobed. And he made a board game that he calls the Enlightenment Game. And it's a kind of complicated board game with all cards of different kinds that you get and pieces that move and dice and different combinations. And as you progress through this Enlightenment Game, you roll the dice or whatever and go around the board and you come periodically to difficult tasks. And in those difficult tasks, you meet that difficult task and then you get a card which allows for different responses. One is to run the other way. The second is to talk about it for a little bit and then run the other way. The third is to confront it completely. And the fourth is to learn from it, kind of graded in that way. So a sample task might be that you have some great misfortune that befalls you on this board to yourself or to your family. And then you have these series of responses. And the way that you're allowed to determine which response you choose and therefore how further you go around the board toward the place of enlightenment depends on how many of the qualities of these inner perfections of Buddha nature you have recognized or developed or cultivated in yourself. So, for example, when this great misfortune hits your family or yourself on the board game, if you have a wisdom card, then you use it and you move closer to enlightenment. But if you don't have the wisdom card and you get confused, then you go backward on the board. Similarly, if you have the patience card, then you don't go backwards. You can at least stay where you are, you know, or you become a little bit wiser. Do you understand? So the situations that we meet in life periodically are pleasant or unpleasant, painful or beautiful. They keep changing. Anybody have anything different than that? Okay, so that's how it happens. Then depending on how we are able to use the dedication of our heart, the energy, the innate understanding, the compassion, those situations become useful to us. This is from Don Juan's teachings to Castaneda. He says, "Only as a warrior can one withstand the path of knowledge. For a spiritual warrior, everything that comes is a challenge, while for an ordinary person, they are only a blessing or a curse. For a spiritual warrior, there are only challenges, and challenges cannot possibly be good or bad. Challenges are simply challenges." This quality of dedication is our heart's capacity to stick to a course that we've chosen, to values that are true to us, to the honesty within ourselves. Several years ago, we had a big teacher meeting at Spirit Rock, 115 or 20 Buddhist teachers from around the country. And one of the lecturers at that time was a friend named Michael Mead, who worked for many years in the men's movement. And here were all these people, Western Zen masters and lamas and swamis and mamas and stuff like that. And Michael was teaching. A couple of people said, "Well, what's this guy doing teaching? I mean, we've sat in monasteries and we've done 3-month and 3-year retreats and stuff. And what gives him the authority to speak to us about meditation or our life of practice?" Michael, when he was a young man, was born into an Irish Catholic family that everybody had been a soldier at some point, his uncles and grandparents. And it was the Vietnam War time, and he'd heard various things about maybe it wasn't the right thing to do to go into it, but he didn't know, and then he was drafted, and he said, "Well, I guess I'll go and see." And as he was drafted, he was sent down to Panama for training. And in the base in Panama, the Vietnam vets who were coming back from Vietnam, a number of them were coming as well, and they began to talk to the people who were training to go there and tell them their experience, that, you know, this is a really weird war. You can't really tell who you're fighting and what you're doing it for, and you're hitting an awful lot of civilians, and all the kinds of doubts and so forth that we're familiar with, even from people who went with some initial good energy. And as he heard more and more, he began to think this was the wrong thing to do. So he began to question his officers. But in questioning his officers, they said, "You don't question. You're in the army now, sir. You just do it." And he questioned more and began to get other people questioned. They didn't like it, and they told him to shut up or he would be, you know, given some punishment. And he began to question more. And they said, you know, he could be court-martialed. And he said, "That's all right. I just need to find out." So they decided another tactic. They said, "Let's make him in charge of his platoon. Maybe that will help. You know, there's this hill, soldier, you're practicing, take your guys up there." And he said, "Why?" So that failed. And at some point he began to realize that he didn't want to do what they were telling him because it didn't make any sense. So they said, "You can't do this, you're a soldier." And he said, this is not the right thing to do. And gradually they began to give him orders and he began to disobey simply by not responding. And finally he was thrown into prison after receiving on his record the most citations for court-martial of anyone in the history of the U.S. Army by successively disobeying all these orders. So they put him in there and they said, "We're going to lock you up for a long time, soldier." And he got in his prison cell and he just sat there for a while and he said, "This army stuff, this what they're doing is wrong. It's really crazy. And I'm not going to participate." And he sat for a while. And then he took off his uniform and he wadded it up and he pushed it through the bars of the cell. And so there he was in his cell in Panama, sort of hot, so didn't need clothes. He was naked. And then he said, "I'm not going to sleep on that army cot." And he lay down on the floor. And they came and they told him to do things. And he said, "I am not in your army." They said, "But you have 60 court-martial citations and you're going to pay for this." And he looked at them and he said, I'm sorry, I don't belong to your system anymore." And over the course of that time, he spent 80 days in prison. And as they began to try to force him to do things, he stopped eating. He said, "I also don't eat your food." So they put him in solitary confinement because he was talking to the other soldiers who were in there and kind of trying to make them question as well. And he said the first number of days they threatened him for a couple weeks. And then after 2 or 3 weeks of his not eating and his kind of just staying there, they sent the psychiatrist. And he had such good conversations that the psychiatrist kept coming back to talk to him. Then they sent the army chaplain down and they became very good friends. But he kept losing weight. And then the officers came down and tried to convince him, you know, that it was a path that wouldn't work. And he just said, I'm not in the army anymore, and this is not what I do. And he got thinner and thinner, and they were going to send him to another prison for quite a long time. And word began to get out, and there were some reporters that were going to come and interview him. The army got a little bit nervous, and some friends of his who found out about it wrote letters. And finally he got, after 80 days of being in there and not eating for 60 of them, he went from like 200 pounds down to 115 pounds. They came in one day and they said, you've received a pardon. Robert Kennedy signed it, and we will give you an honorable discharge. And he looked out from the cell and he said, I don't want an honorable discharge. I won't go unless you give me a dishonorable discharge. Because I'm not leaving honorably, and this is not an honorable thing that you're doing. And so after 80 days, he was led out and he was put on a plane back to New York, filled with vets coming back from Vietnam. And at first he was quite nervous, and people were talking about who this guy was. And then two big men who were in the Green Berets, one sat on either side of him. He said he didn't know what was going to happen. And they sat down and they said, we heard about you in your cell. They said, it sounds like just what we did in Nam. And they began to swap their stories. And they said, we'll take care of you. And they brought him back and they put him in a cab and took him home. And all the work that he's done, he now does a lot of work in the inner city with Latino and African-American youth gangs. And they say to him, how do you know that you can stand up to the kind of violence and the force and the pain and the difficulty that they have to deal with? And he looks at him and he says, you can do it. You can do it. So this is the quality of dedication to what we value. And in the forest monasteries where I practiced and learned, my old teacher, Ajahn Chah, used to talk about living in caves and living out in the forest in the storms and walking on foot and going from one distant place to another in this very, very simple fashion of a forest monk. You didn't know it because he sat there so peacefully and he wasn't fighting with anything. Recently, a Japanese Zen master in Minneapolis was asked by a student about the beautiful quality of faith and warmth that he radiated, much like my own teacher. That's what I want to learn from you. How do I learn that? Asked the student. Katagiri Roshi answered, when people see me today, they don't see the years and years I spent just being with my teacher. And he described how he'd practiced year after year, living simply, hearing the same Dharma teachings over and over and over, sitting every morning no matter what, doing the rituals of the temple, just giving himself, dedicating himself to what he valued over and over again. Or Thongpulu Sayadaw, who was an old master from Burma and a teacher of mine, who's this sweet, very compassionate old man who took a vow at some point in his monastic life. He said, I really want to be awake in my life, so I will not lie down to sleep. I'll just sit. And he hadn't laid down for 30 years. You know, he had a comfortable chair now that he was in his 80s. He kind of leaned back in it. That was as far as he would go. I looked at him and said, Beth, now that's impossible. These old guys. But Ajahn Chah's, and they are, it's really quite remarkable. Ajahn Chah had a Dharma brother, Ajahn Tate, another of these old forest monks, who died this last year in his 90s. And his teacher, it was the same man who taught my own teacher, who taught Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Tate was a young monk and practiced very ardently. And at some point, being in the forest, there arose in him this great sense of light and visions and beautiful, spacious mind that was filled with brilliant white light. And he went to some other monks who were there and said, am I practicing correctly? And they said, yes, this is beautiful. Let the rapture and the light grow. And he said, but my master, who's gone off wandering in other parts of the forest, said not to go out into the great reaches of mind, but to keep my practice connected with every step and every breath and with this body. Shouldn't I do that? And they said, well, we don't know. We're not sure. Maybe the other is okay. We don't know. And he got different answers. And he said, well, I've got to go ask my teacher. Does anyone know where he went? Well, last heard, he went from northeast to northern Thailand. All right, I'll go. Who wants to walk with me? And he ended up spending 2 years walking across the country of Thailand and then across the country of Burma looking for his teacher and going through all kinds of difficulties and walking over some pretty high mountains and getting terribly sick and so forth. And finally he found his teacher in this remote village in Burma. And the teacher said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I had an important question to ask you. And I asked others and they said this and then some others said that. And I know you know. And it's so important because I've dedicated myself that since I'm doing this meditation, I'm going to do it right. And I want to know, should I go into the light and all these things, or should I stay with my moment-to-moment experience? And his teacher looked back, and he said, stay with your moment-to-moment experience. There is where your great freedom will come. It's not someplace else, it's here. Now, one hears these stories. These are kind of like the myths from Tibet of Milarepa and so forth. And you say, well, you know, that's nice. That's for somebody else in some other time. But I don't know. A few weeks ago, I visited my friend and colleague, teacher Ruth Dennison, a Vipassana teacher. And her husband, Henry, who's in his 80s, has Alzheimer's. And he gets angry all the time, just coming up in him and confused and lit his house on fire. Part of it burned down, and she kind of took him out of his house and brought him out to her little meditation center, made a place for him and takes care of him. And he doesn't want anyone else around. He yells at them and throws things. He's very difficult. She said, I can't put him in a home. I just can't do that to him. You know, we lived together for so many years. I cannot do it. I said, so what do you do, Ruth? She said, I'm taking care of him. I go and I do a Dharma talk in the meditation hall, and I go back and I see if Henry's okay. You know, and I don't sleep so much, and she's nearly 75. And I just do it. She was actually quite exhausted, and I was concerned for her. I said, you know, you need to get some help with this. She said, I know I need to get help. But I looked at her, and I saw that same quality of just being willing to do what you value. The Hasidic rabbi, Zusha, was asked by his students, how does one live a life that's of benefit to others? And he said, I cannot teach you the principles of service to this earth, but a little child and a thief could perhaps show you the way. From the child you can learn three things. He is merry for no particular reason. Never for a moment is he idle. And when he needs something, he demands it vigorously. The thief can instruct you further in seven more things. He does his service even by night. Even in the dark, he will do it. And if he does not finish what he set out to do in one night, he devotes the next night to it. And he and those who work with him love one another. He risks his life for what he wishes to gain. And what he takes home has in the end so little value that he gives it up for a very small cost. Does it again. He endures blows and hardship, and it matters little to him. And he likes his trade and would not exchange it for any other. Now that may be a little bit romantic. But it's an old Hasidic master speaking about finding delight or dedication or caring in the things that we value. Zen Master Suzuki Roshi talked about meditation in that way, or spiritual life, as like baking bread. You bake one loaf and another, hundreds of loaves of bread. You put yourself in the oven. You bake yourself each time that you sit in meditation. And it happens, this quality of dedication is inherent in our sitting practice. You sit here, and your mind wanders off, doesn't it? And you bring it back, and sadness comes, or happiness comes. You know, we talk about training the puppy. Okay, come back again. Notice what's here. and it goes away again. Bring it back 1,000 times, often in one sitting, or hundreds of times, in a day of meditation and a retreat, over and over again, the dedication to come back and say, yes, this is so now, here I am again. The 3-month retreat, which we have every year in the center in the East Coast in Barrie, becomes even more that way. It's kind of like this great container, and there's pain and pleasure and bodily energies and mind states, and people will come in as they did today in my interviews in this 3-week retreat. You know, and one man came in and he said to me this morning in an interview, he said, you know, I woke up this morning and I was really depressed. I just had no energy. I felt really bad. I said, yes. He said, and then I had breakfast and I went to take a walk and the sun hit the trees outside and this grace filled me and I just felt euphoric. It was kind of the opposite. I said, yes. He said, but then when I came to sit the first sitting after that, the depression came back somewhat. I was felt kind of sad and didn't know what I was doing and doubting. Oh, but by the end of the sitting, it cleared and I felt good again, you know, and then it came back a bit. And this was now about 11 in the morning I was seeing him. And he said, it was just amazing. And I looked at him and I said, you're a psychiatrist, right? Which he was. He said, yes. I said, so what you're seeing is the mind. He said, oh, yeah. Interesting. Pain, pleasure, energy states, thoughts, feelings, they change like the weather. They come and they go. And it is our dedication in meditation, or what we choose, that creates a crucible for it to be turned like alchemy into gold, into something of value. This is from Rumi. He writes all these animal fables. In this case, it's a vegetable fable. A chickpea leaps almost over the rim of the pot where it's being boiled. Why are you doing this to me? It yells. The cook knocks it back down with the ladle. Don't you try to jump out. You think I'm torturing you. I'm giving you flavor so you can mix with the spices and rice and be the lovely vitality of a human being. Remember when you drank rain in the garden and grew to your fullness, it was for this. So our inner knowing of what we value and following it, this quality of dedication, becomes that crucible for something of value to grow, whether it's in your love relationship or work or spiritual life or service. Before I was married, I was thinking about, you know, the vows that one takes, the marriage vows or the wedding vows, that you will honor and love and respect and care for this person for the rest of your life. At least that's, I think, still the wedding vows, isn't it? Even in California, and we still take those vows. Just checking here. Anyway, so I was going to take them. And I began to wonder, how can you take a vow like that and really mean it? Because after all, things do change, like that experience of that psychiatrist in the meditation retreat this morning. They change so much. And I wondered, how can I say this and really mean it? So I decided to go to talk to an old married couple who had been married for 45 years and whose relationship was beautiful to me. They'd raised a number of children and they were really an inspiration, an old Quaker couple that I knew. And I sat down with them. I said, I want to talk because I'm going to get married. And I want to know, how can you go into a marriage and make this kind of commitment and really know that you've made it for your whole life? How do you know that that's the right thing? And they looked back and they said, you can't. You don't. I said, you don't? I said, then how do you do it? And they said, you make it every day. Each morning when you get up, you make the same dedication, the same vow over and over. It's not just once, but it's that direction that one sets one's heart to do again and again. Again, then, our meditation practice in this very formal way of sitting is a kind of crucible. And it's our willingness to be present that begins to transform what arises, grief comes and people weep as they meditate, feel the losses and the unfinished business and the need for forgiveness, and joy arises and anger comes and excitement and planning and creativity and releases of energy and the way things are supposed to be and the way they're not supposed to be. And every story, I mean, if you want to hear every story, just sit still and begin to listen, because the mind will do it. You know, it just pours out stories. It's kind of the story factory, isn't it? And you sit, and some of them are beautiful, and you say, now I've got it, you know, and then a few hours later, oh, now I lost it. And extraordinary things will happen, and painful things. And in the midst of it all comes this knowing from your own Buddha nature. Yes, I can sit in the midst of this, and this, and this, bow to this too, allow this too. Compassion grows, wisdom grows, the quality of presence that allows you to sit with someone who's in pain or dying and hold their hand, and they know that you're not so afraid because you've sat with that yourself. Or someone in labor giving birth to a child, it's okay, I know that one too. We all are born, we all die, we all experience these changes. And there's a place in us of wisdom that knows this. It grows through this dedication. In the Tao it says, the gentlest thing overcomes the hardest. Like water overcoming the stone in the long run, the drops of water wearing away the stone. The dedication begins to transform whatever it is we set our heart upon. Or Thomas Merton, who writes, true prayer and love are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and your heart has turned to stone. That's the place that we really learn something. I know when I've worked with people who come, kind of the years I did as a psychologist and working in therapy with people, at some points we would hit a place of the deepest despair, feeling like they were dying or ashes, the whole world was desolate. And rather than try to get out of that, I would often say, all right, sit and close your eyes and feel how big is the desolation or how vast is the ashes that the world has been reduced to. Often it would fill the whole sky, the whole earth, the solar system, the whole universe. I'd sit and, all right, stay there with it. Just let it be as long as it wants. Oh, it's going to be here forever. Well, let's sit here forever then. Let's see what happens. 100,000 years, imagine. A 1,000,000 years, 5,000,000 years pass. You're just sitting here in the universe, 10 million, 100 million years. And we would sit together. This is more likely 5 minutes, but 500 million years. How's it going? Oh, it's desolate. It's painful. 1,000,000,000 years, you know, we got time, it's all right. Another 100 million years. And then inevitably at some point they would start to shake their head. I'd say, what's that? Oh, I don't want to see that. Well, what's happening? Something's happening. Let it go, don't worry. Another 100 million years, 200 million years. Sitting, shake their head again. What is it? There's a light over there somewhere. Oh, why don't you go see what it is? Oh, there's something green over there. I'm not ready for it, but there it is. You know, there's a whole new planet, and it's just being born. It always happens. It is the nature of our life and the nature of our heart. Something new always wants to be born. This life force is unstoppable. The force that pushes those little green plants through the cracks in the sidewalk. That's us. We are that too. So there are vows that are taken in the certain Buddhist centers. Every day they're chanted, the Bodhisattva vows. Beings in the universe are numberless. I vow to liberate them all. Dharmas are infinite, all the teachings. I vow to master them all. Obstacles are endless. That one you know very well. I vow to overcome them all. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. these impossible things. Beings are numberless, I'm going to save them all. And really what these vows are is simply a direction of the heart. That even if the sun comes up in the west, the bodhisattva, the being committed to compassion and liberation, has only one way. No matter how the world turns or changes, I still vow to stay true to awakening, to respect, to compassion in any circumstance. And like those marriage vows that my friend talked about, one takes them every day, again and again and again. This is still my commitment. Rumi calls it setting your heart on gold. Listening inside and saying, this life that I've been given, what does my heart say is most important, most deeply valued? And then doing it, this inner spirit. It's like Napoleon who said, at the end of my life, the most amazing thing I discovered was that the sword is always beaten by the spirit. It is always true. So this quality of dedication isn't gaining or wanting something to happen. It's rather the direction of our heart that says, this is what I value and I will live this. Life shrinks or expands according to one's courage. Try it. This step and this step, it builds on one another. When nothing seems to help, I go look at a stone cutter hammering away at a rock perhaps 100 times without as much as a crack showing in it. Yet at the 101st blow, it will split in two. And I know it was not that blow that did it, but the 100 that had gone before as well. It's amazing, you know, when we commit ourselves to something, everything in us changes. Our cells somehow get the message and realign. And often karma, providence, whatever you want to call it, changes as well. You begin to do something and you really believe it, and things start to move with us. They follow that energy. They follow our heart. Now, one of the really lovely practices in this tradition of meditation is the practice of metta, or loving-kindness meditation. Part of the way that the formal practice of loving-kindness is done is that one sits or walks and uses a series of phrases which give voice to the intention of the heart, wishing well for oneself, a loved one, a benefactor, and so forth. So you begin with a simple phrase, if it were for yourself, loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful. Or may I be filled with loving kindness. Or may I have well-being of body and heart and mind. Or you might wish that for another person. You picture this person you love. May they be well. May they be filled with loving kindness. And you repeat it over and over all day long, especially if you're doing an intensive practice of this, on a retreat for 10 days or 2 weeks or a month, and you just repeat that over and over. And sometimes you feel it and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you feel annoyed or doubting, or it brings up its opposite. And you keep repeating it over and over and over, no matter what happens, that it's the intention, even if you don't feel it. And something happens to people after they've repeated it 10,000 times or 20,000 or 30,000 or however much happens in a few days or a week or 10 days or a month, all of a sudden you're saying it and in a moment you fill with it. It's as if setting that as the direction of the heart creates it. And then you're sitting there and the heart and mind become completely connected with that phrase and you say, may you be filled with loving kindness. And you picture that person and the whole universe and you and they in the middle of it is filled with this light. And the mind becomes very steady and still. May you be happy, and your whole body and they, in your imagination, become filled with happiness because you've said it 20,000 times and begins to have an effect. And then when your mind becomes very still and stable, concentrated and steady, as I describe, then you can do the smallest thing. You can say, may happiness arise. And your whole body just gets filled with happiness. May joy arise. And joy fills you and it just bubbles out of your body. May I be filled with loving kindness. And whatever comes into your view, whoever they are, you just love them. It's fantastic. And it comes really simply through this quality of dedication and repetition. It's fantastic. Rumi puts it this way. He says, love everyone. Start a large, useless project like Noah. It doesn't matter. Just do it from your heart. The power of intention or commitment to what we value is extraordinary. Doing it again and again, and it grows. It's the seed we plant and the watering of it and the nurturing, and it grows for us. Did you know that in 1905, Einstein's dissertation was turned down at the University of, where was it, Bern or Basel, as irrelevant and fanciful? Sorry, you don't understand, Albert. Come down to earth. Right? And that Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team. That poor coach. Thinking of celebrities. It is the stepping into the unknown again and again with our heart facing the direction that we value that matters. Somebody questioned the Dalai Lama about this at one point. They said, you know, you deal with so much suffering and loss and difficulty, and Tibetans, and don't you ever get disheartened? Don't you ever have doubts? How do you deal with all this struggle? And he said, I come back to my sincere motivation, that it has been my wish every day when I wake up that what actions I do, I don't know what their results will be, but that whatever action I do it that it may bring peace, that it may bring compassion, that it may bring benefit. And so I begin to doubt and I don't know what the right thing to do, and all I can do is come back to my heart's wish that as best I can, I intend them to be of value. Can you understand the power of that? It's so simple. This is from Martin Luther King. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King tried to love somebody. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that, I was a drum major. Say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. I just want to leave a committed life behind. When we stop and sense and feel our spirit, we know there is this same greatness in us, in each one of us. It resonates. We love that. And this is the place of dedication. And it can be in the smallest thing. This is from Emerson. He says, to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest criticism and endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty and find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, this is to have succeeded. It's that small and beautiful and simple. This spirit of dedication to what we value, I like to see it in little children. My favorite age are toddlers because they're kind of like they're drunk and they're kind of walking around and going from one thing to another, you know. And when they first learn to walk, little kids, first they learn to cruise, which is not singles bars. It's a kind of a preschool thing, where you get up from crawling and you're not able to walk yet, and cruising is that activity of using the edge of the couch or the table or the furniture and kind of using it to help you walk. And then you start to walk on your own. We all did it. And you watch this toddler and they walk one step or two steps and then they fall, usually on this big fat diaper, whoomp, right? And they stand up again and they take a couple more steps and then whoomp, you know, and then they take a few more steps and they aim toward the wall, they fall that way. And they do it 10,000 times. And not only that, they have a kick doing it. Wow, big smile, let's try that again. A couple more steps, whoomp, fall again. The spirit is so beautiful. And it's the beauty of seeing something that can be done, that matters, and facing in that direction and doing it. The practice that we do, the practices of compassion and loving kindness, are that simple. And when we discover this quality of dedication or follow our heart or our spirit, this trust that we give to it is returned to us. Again from Don Juan, speaks of his compatriot Don Gennaro. He says, Gennaro's love is the world. He was just now embracing this enormous earth, but since he's so little, all he can do is swim on it. But the earth knows that Gennaro loves it, and it bestows on him its care. And that's why Gennaro's life is filled to the brim, and his state, wherever he'll be, will be plentiful. Only if one loves this earth and this life with unbending passion can one release one's sadness. A spiritual warrior is always joyful because their love is unalterable and their beloved, the earth, embraces them and bestows upon them inconceivable gifts. Only the love of this splendorous life can give freedom to a warrior spirit, and this freedom is joy, efficiency, and abandon in the face of any odds. That is the last lesson. It is always left for the very last moment, for the moment of ultimate solitude when a person faces their death and aloneness. Only then does it make sense. It's really moment by moment. It's not a big thing, this dedication. It's a dedication, this moment to be present, this moment of compassion, this moment of our willingness to rest again in our Buddha nature. And then it is the journey itself, not the goal, but the journey that becomes beautiful, the journey done for its own sake. When we go into the city, cross over the Golden Gate Bridge, one of my daughter, who's now 12, Caroline's favorite things is that we pay the toll for the car behind us, you know. And she's always looking out to say, all right, who's going to be behind us this time? She hopes it will be like a couple of businessmen dressed in suits and looking kind of glum or something like that. You know, she says, let's kind of get somebody behind us who's really having a hard day. And then we go in and we give them, you know, our $6, right, and say it's for the car behind us. And she says, okay, Daddy, now don't go too fast because I want to see what happens. And at first, the toll taker says, you know, so the car in front of you paid, and they look to see if they know the person. She's there waving. And then this perplexity turns to this great grin. It doesn't matter who it is. It's totally wonderful. To make things beautiful little by little, moment by moment, to fashion out of your life like a garland of beautiful flowers, a garland of moments that come from the dedication of your heart. Let's sit. as we sit quietly, ask yourself a few questions, kind of a reflection in your own heart's meditation. First question, what have you set your heart upon in this life? And if nothing is apparent, then you might ask yourself, why not? And how aware are we of this dedication? How conscious is our resolve? If you were to make your own spiritual vows or direction to set your life course in, what would it be that you would seek to live or embody?
This concludes part 8 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with part 9.